everybody. And first of all, thank you for being willing to participate in this remote argument. We understand that from time to time there are glitches or interruptions, pets, family members, that sort of thing, doorbells. We'll try to be as patient as we can and ask the same of you if you'd indulge us. And we'll try to keep these interruptions to a minimum during our conversations this morning. Why don't we go ahead and call the case, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. Case number A-20-0846, Hogan versus Brass.
All right, good morning. Ms. Spaulding, on behalf of appellant, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Pam Spaulding and I'm here today on behalf of the appellants Devin and Douglas Hogan. This is a personal injury action involving a then 12-year-old boy, Devin, who was injured in September of 2013 in an ATV crash. The crash occurred at Brass's homestead during an overnight weekend stay. Devin pursued a claim against Brass, the adult, who directed Devin to operate Brass's ATV at only 12 years old with an 11-year-old passenger without helmets on a public road, no adult supervision, and a crash occurred. All these conditions were against the ATV manufacturer's warranties and really common sense. The district court-
Are you arguing that they were reckless?
That Brass was reckless, that he was negligent. One of the factors in the act is recklessness. No, our claim is purely negligence against Mr. Brass.
So not so far against common sense that it becomes reckless.
Correct. And the district court erred here when it ruled that Brass was completely immune from civil liability under the Minnesota Nonprofits Corporation Act, which we'll refer to today as MNCA. And it erred in really two respects. Number one, it's our position that this act does not apply here whatsoever. And then if it did, that Brass, who bears the burden, failed to meet each element of the act. So I'm just gonna tackle both of those in turn. Number one, the district court ruled as a matter of law that Brass was covered under the act, but PWP and its program specifically, and Brass will admit, said that overnight stays are specifically prohibited and it's not part of the mentoring role. So when Brass took Devin on an overnight stay, he excluded himself from this particular act. But even if we get to the point where the act does apply here, it's our position that he cannot prove one of the elements, in fact, the second element of the act, is he cannot prove that his act or omission was within the scope of his responsibilities as a mentor of PWP. And at a minimum, Your Honors, the district court ruled all these issues as a matter of law. And at a minimum, there are factual disputes here and it was error for the court to do so. So number one, it is-
Holding, can I jump you around? I'm sorry for taking you off your outline. Feel free to jump back in if you address the question, but I'm looking at the Rain decision, which you do discuss significantly in your brief, but there's some language in the Rain decision I'd like you to address, where the Supreme Court there determined that what we're looking at here is not under the statute, not the scope of the duties, but on behalf of the nonprofit corporation. And it's interesting language, but I'd like you to address it. Consequently, we hold that the broad wording of the statute protects all non-compensated persons acting on behalf of the nonprofit corporation, not just those uncompensated persons acting within the specific scope of their duties.
And Your Honor, in this particular case, I think that the question really was because her advice that she provided regarding how you clean that surface was not as a board member, that the board member had a specific outline of what those duties were. She was outside the scope of her board member duties when providing that advice. But the court here said, well, we're not just protecting people under the category of a board member, but she got the protection of the act because she was a member or an agent of the organization when she provided that advice. Here we're challenging for sure the prong two of was Brass even within the scope, but even broader than that, whether or not he should be even be protected by this act in the first place before you even get to the elements. So in that particular case, I think the reason why that was so important is because they were trying to distinguish between her being a board member and her being unprotected or just being an agent member.
So can I, if that answers your question, Judge Ross, I don't want to interrupt. Okay. So my question is, this was a summary judgment. So what specifically are the disputed facts? I mean, I hear that there's the characterization of the facts, you know, but that's a question of law. So what are the specific facts? What's the fact issue here that a jury would need to decide?
Well, in two respects. Number one, I suppose, you know, there's an issue regarding the overnight stay. Is this categorized as an overnight stay? And there's some, you know, the defendant has taken the position that an overnight stay means that the activity had to have happened at night or during the nighttime. And I think the district court took that as well. I suppose that the easiest way to say that there's a fact question here is maybe within the scope of the responsibilities when you look at the prongs, because what was Brass supposed to do as a mentor of this program? It was supposed to be providing healthy, positive opportunities for Devin. And in this particular case, in my opinion, and I think there's a fact question whether this particular act or admission putting Devin in such a unsafe, dangerous position was even within the scope of his responsibilities as a mentor. So
Can I pause you there? I have trouble with that argument because it sounds like what you're saying is the statute that's designed to create immunity for negligent acts doesn't apply if you're working with an organization that encourages non-negligent acts. Because a negligent act is outside the scope of the services provided by the organization, because the organization wants to encourage non-negligence, therefore the statute doesn't apply. That seems to be the you know, breaking your argument down to its essential elements, that kind of gets us to that place, doesn't it?
Well, I think if any negligent act would be automatically immune, you know, the court could have, well, first of all, the legislature could have done that when creating and writing the act, but it didn't. It put specific prongs in it, and it said, you know, was it in good faith? Was it within the scope of the person's responsibility?
Right. But I think I thought what you're arguing is that this isn't even part of what the organization is about, which is about creating safe experiences, because it was a negligent act, and it, you know, putting a kid on an ATV without a helmet is therefore both negligent and outside the scope of the mission of the organization. But it's outside the scope of the mission of the organization because it's negligent.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you see the circular problem I have with your argument?
Yeah, I do. I guess my only response to that would be is that, you know, I still think that, you know, somebody, I mean, maybe we're mixing up and talking about good faith versus negligence. I don't know how to specifically address that. You know, but that I do believe, and one thing I did agree with the district court in their position is that a person can still be acting in good faith and still be be negligent.
Right, but your argument was that because this is unsafe conduct, and safe conduct is what is, you know, that's not, that doesn't go to the good safe element. It goes to the scope element, doesn't it?
It does. And perhaps maybe then the broader argument really should be that, you know, Brass doesn't deserve immunity here anyway, just simply because of the fact that he took Devin on an overnight stay, and the overnight stays were specifically prohibited by PWP. And there's, you know, obviously legitimate reasons why, you know, mentors should be restricted in some of their activities and should not be taking mentees on overnight stays.
Can I pause you there for just a fact question so I understand? So when during the, I don't know if this was a hunting trip or just a cabin stay, whatever it was, when in terms of days did the accident occur? Was it on the first day that he took, Mr. Brass took Devin to the cabin, or was it sometime later?
Right. The trip started on a Friday, and this incident occurred on Saturday around 5 o'clock. And I think the intent was to drive back home to the cities on Sunday.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but sorry to interrupt you too, by the way. I didn't know if you had finished answering Judge Siegel's question.
Ms. Spaulding, I'd like to ask a question following up on what Judge Ross said, but I also want to make sure you've had a chance to finish your answer that Judge Siegel asked. So if you need to take any additional time, I think it's a good question about what facts below are still open.
Right, and I guess it's not necessarily that that there are facts in dispute. I think that we've got just the way in which those were interpreted. But I do think that the district court here did make some factual findings by saying that, you know, the Brass was number one within the scope of his responsibilities as a member of PWP during this particular incident, when the he allowed Devin to drive the ATV under these conditions. So, but in any respect, I mean, we still are on summary judgment phase, and I do believe that this court still gets to review the case in a de novo application.
So I was thinking about Judge Ross's question, and I'm having a hard time answering it or even coming up with examples. I think part of the reason is because of the nature of this organization and of mentorship. And we kind of presume that having a safe relationship with your mentee is part of what it means to be a mentor. So I guess the question then becomes, can you think of any examples where you can be negligent but still be safe? So it's a negligent safe act that could potentially fall into this category. And so you're not excluding the entire organization the act from applying to this organization, because it would still apply if there's a safe negligent act. But I can't think of what that might look like as I'm standing here. I don't know if you've had an example or not.
I cannot think of one right now either. A safe negligent act.
I think you'd have a hard time in light of the definition of negligence. I mean, if you're causing an unreasonable risk of harm, I think by definition that's unsafe. And by your argument, then that would make it a legal determination every time for this particular organization, which only fosters reasonable behavior, which makes it sort of it would be odd to me that to assume that the legislature was intending their act to essentially cover or not cover all organizations that provide mentorship relationships. I'm pretty sure that every organization that has a mentorship component assumes and prefers that the mentorship be reasonable and safe.
So can I just ask one quick question? And that is, if this ATV accident had happened in a single afternoon. It was not out of town. It did not involve an overnight stay. It was a 4 hours. I live out in the country, but not so far away that I can't get back and forth to Devin's home within a 4 hour period of time. Would that then have been covered by immunity? Is it really that this kind of, it was a whole weekend activity that pulls it out? Is that the core of the argument?
I think if that was our situation here, Your Honor, I think we wouldn't be talking about whether or not the act itself applies. Then we would be here today just acting or talking about whether within those conditions, if they still applied, was within the scope of Brass's responsibilities as a mentor of PWP. So I do think that we'd still be here today arguing the point, but the focus would be just a little bit more narrow and just showing that Brass could not meet his burden of proof regarding those elements, or at a minimum, the judge shouldn't have taken this away from Devin to be able to argue it to a court and have a trial decide those issues.
Judge Bryan, may I offer one more question?
Please, go ahead.
All right. So I want you to assume exactly what happened here, but that this wasn't an overnight stay. That, I mean, I'm assuming that the cabin, since it was in Minnesota, was certainly within driving distance of the Twin Cities. And let's assume they got up early in the morning. Mr. Brass picked up the young man, took him up to the cabin. And 5 minutes after they got there, this accident occurred outside the view of Mr. Brass, but he was intending to drive Devin back before midnight. Then your only argument then, it seems to me, is the one that I've suggested is circular.
Yes.
And all right, I'll save any other questions.
But I still don't, yes, Your Honor, you're right, you're yes.
Well, you'll have a chance to expand on that in rebuttal because your time's expired. I appreciate you. I know you had something you wanted to say, but you looked at the clock. So we appreciate you trying to keep us on schedule, because frankly, I think if it were up to just the judges without a clock, we might be here all day. We'll look forward to your rebuttal argument. Mr. Bracken, go ahead.
Good morning. Ryan Bracken on behalf of my client, the respondent, Mr. Bill Brass. First off, I just want to say that this case, and really this appeal, it goes to the heart and the intent of the volunteer immunity statute. What we have here, the respondent, he embodied the actions and the conduct that this statute seeks to encourage. And this
Wait, I'm sorry, but I just need to interrupt you here for a minute. So at some point, there is a limit to this statute. So this, your client had this kid up for a weekend. And I think what your client has done with this child sounds absolutely commendable and what we should all be doing. So it's not at all a criticism of your client. But he sent him on an errand. Here, you go retrieve, was it a trap hunting machine or something? He sends him off. It wasn't the kid going off being a kid going, whoa, this is fun. I'm going to drive around on this ATV. He sent him off on an errand for, as far as we know, your client's own benefit, not necessarily the kid's benefit. The kid could have been happy doing any number of things. He didn't insist, I'm only happy doing trap hunting. So doesn't that at some point, how do we say there's a limit here?
Well, by the way, I think it's trap shooting. I don't think you
trap know. Shooting. I'm sorry. I meant trap shooting. And we don't have time, but there's a very funny story about how my husband as a high school kid worked behind one of those things, throwing things up and almost got killed. But thankfully he's still alive. All right. Sorry to take up your time. We'll give you extra time.
No problem.
That sounds very negligent. Whatever happened to him.
To address your question, I think that's exactly what the legislature did in putting these three elements together for this statute. There's a good faith component, there's a scope component, and within the scope component, negligence is protected. The court in Rain made that explicitly clear. And then there's the third component of the statute that prohibits willful and reckless misconduct. And here in this case, we have no allegations that this act was in bad faith, and we have no allegations that this act was willful or reckless misconduct. And I think those are the limits that the statute prescribed. And there is a fourth, I should say, too, an exception to that is if it's personally and directly caused. But here we're dealing strictly with negligence.
Can I get at what I think is the problem for your case? And you can press me back if you think I should be disabused from this. You rely heavily on the Rain decision. And in the Rain decision, it's clear that the actor in that case was acting on behalf of the organization, trying to meet the organization's objectives. And that's where this language comes in that I was pressing Ms. Spaulding about, where you're acting on behalf of the organization, even if it's not within the scope of your duties. In this case, we've got an organization that specifically and without any dispute defines its mission as providing day trip mentoring. And we know this because that's in the training. We know that because it's even in the permission slip that was provided to your client, that the scope of this organization's mission is mentoring with a particular durational element, not just active. Here in Rain, we're talking about the specific activities that were going on. Here, and the district court here in this case seemed to focus on what kind of activity. Was it a nighttime activity or a daytime activity? I think, in my view, or at least it's where I'm starting, my starting point here, acting on a misunderstanding of the limits that the organization put on its own mission, which was a durational one. The even in the permission slip, the organization says, during an overnight stay, during a hunting trip, it's a durational issue. So if the organization says that our mission is to provide this sort of this range of our mentoring services, and the range is going to include a sort of a time limit, then what difference does it make whether your client was acting in good faith or not, whether he was negligent or not, whether the activities were or were not within the kind of activities that he might have engaged in appropriately within the durational range. If the question is just a statutory application one, which is what was within the scope, what is the scope of the organization's mission, and was your client acting within that scope? It seems to me if he's acting outside the scope of the mission, he doesn't fall within the immunity of the statute. I've given you a long-winded question. I took a whole lot of time asking it, so hopefully Judge Brian will take that into consideration and giving you time to answer and answer other questions.
Yeah, of course, and I'll do my best to kind of unwind and address the pieces of that. First off, I think there's an issue here in which the trial court did find, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Bress had requested permission for an overnight. So I believe that their language was the mentorship organization sought to expand the mentorship opportunities available to the appellant, but did seek to put a limitation on that. And here's where it gets, I guess, somewhat interesting is.
And that's based on, I'm sorry, you're, that's based on the permission slip.
Yes, that's based on the permission slip. The permission slip alone, I think, is somewhat of a de facto proof of permission was requested and received. And there's the disputed fact, which the court discusses. One of the disputed underlying facts that goes to scope is essentially that knowledge component, whether or not Mr. Brass was aware of the permission slip's contents or whether or not he had received it ahead of time.
Well, I'll have more questions about the permission slip, but go ahead and finish answering the question as it was posed.
Yeah, and I think I'm trying to with parsing out the legal standard in terms of, an application of the law and whether or not the court applied the law. Under the immunity statute, I just want to be very clear, this is an erroneous, this is a mixed question of fact and law. And whether or not they erroneously applied the law, that needs to be a clearly erroneous standard, and whether or not they abused their discretion in reaching their conclusion he was within the scope, that's an abuse of discretion standard. And I guess maybe I'm I'm parsing apart. I'm trying to find, and maybe I've been misguided in answering the question here.
Well, I'm not sure that a legal question is an issue that we review for clear error, but simply just basic error. It doesn't have to be clear error. The district court made a mistake of law. And this is a summary judgment decision, which as it falls under the general rubric of a de novo review. But if you're finished answering the question as I posed it, I want to turn your attention to the permission slip, which says pretty clearly, I understand that overnight stays are not part of the mentoring role of Bill Brass. And it seems consistent with the statement earlier, which is that the organization doesn't endorse or promote overnight stays, which is consistent, it seems to me, with the organization's overall mission, which is to provide mentoring services within a temporal duration. And there could be a lot of reasons why they impose a bright line temporal restriction. It might have to do with liability. It might have to do with the insurance that they obtain. It may be that they have to pay twice as much insurance if they allowed for overnight mentoring. So whatever the reason of the organization chose to limit its mentoring role for its mentors to those circumstances that did not include overnight stays. So I'm at a loss for why you believe the permission slip somehow expands the scope of Mr. Brass's agency when the permission slip itself expressly says that it's not part of the mentoring role.
Okay.
And by the way, the permission slip looks to me like just a simple, it'd simply be called waiver of liability for the organization. It's a slip that Mr. Brass himself is not signing. It seems to me just a basic waiver, and the organization is just trying to say, we're not responsible. And by the way, we want you to give permission to Mr. Brass so that he can provide medical care if it's needed without calling you. Otherwise, it doesn't seem to say much more than that. Disabuse me of my impression.
Well, and I think that goes to the court's interpretation of overnight stays, and they did do the temporal analysis. I mean, at the end of the day, the plain and simple truth is this is a permitted activity that occurred during the daytime. It occurred during the daylight hours.
Okay, well, the scope of the relationship, the scope of the mentoring doesn't say, it's daytime or nighttime. It's a durational limit, as I read it. The word during shows up two or three times, even in the permission slip itself. And during is presumably a temporal thing. My concern about your argument and the district court's analysis is that basically if Mr. Brass would have taken Devin on a flight to Hawaii and was there for a month, as long as the activity that occurred might have occurred during the daytime, then then the statute doesn't apply. That seems to me to be a real unusual approach to defining what is and what is with not within the scope of an organization's mission or the scope of the agent acting presumably within the scope of the mission of the organization.
Well, and I think that's a problem where there's a lack of any context or evidence in the record that gives any clear delineation by what the organization meant by overnight stays. And here we've got a situation where on the flip side.
Wait a second. Yes. You're saying that's confusing?
In what sense?
Well, I'm asking you in what sense. You're suggesting that the term overnight stay, that there's no, we don't provide any mentoring for overnight stays or for events that occur or for trips, that's somehow ambiguous?
I'm making right now that the court's interpretation of the term overnight stays was a correct one. And it did it based on the guiding precedent to use the plain and ordinary meaning where there's a lack of any context or evidence to support otherwise. And I guess that's where I'm coming at in terms of the term overnight stay.
So I following up a little bit on the first part of the discussion that you were having with Judge Ross, I'm wondering what you would think if the mentor in a situation in a day trip, let's say. So we take out the overnight trip. It's just a day trip. They get to the mentor's house and the mentor falls asleep, takes a nap. Mentee, unsupervised, gets on an ATV and is injured. Is the act of going to sleep outside the scope of the mentor's, is the mentor no longer acting on behalf of the organization if he goes to sleep?
If it occurred within the context of a mentorship activity, such as having the mentee over to his house, then I think you have a claim of negligence. It's not bad faith. It's not willful or reckless misconduct. We're back to a claim of negligence. And I do think that it falls within the scope.
But if that same person then is awake and directs the child to get on an ATV and go run an errand, they're now immune?
I think they're immune in both their circumstances. And sorry if I wasn't clear on that. Yeah, I believe that that's a claim of negligence. It's within scope and they are immune in both circumstances.
Well,
is there anything that a mentor could do that would be outside the scope during the activity is? Is there any activity that's outside the scope?
Yes. I mean, it's acts of bad faith, acts of willful and reckless misconduct, and acts that are personally and directly caused, such as an individual tort. Those are outside the scope. But one of simple negligence, which is all that's pled here, that falls within the boundaries of scope.
So the statute, well, let's look at, I assume you have the statute handy. The statute refers to, I'm quoting here, an act. I'm going to pause for a moment because I don't know if Chief Judge, oh, there she is.
I'm here. I'm sorry. My statute just blew off the table. So I was just reaching down to grab it.
Okay. I'm sorry. I want to make sure you're still.
No. Go ahead.
The statute refers to an act or omission being within the scope of the person's responsibilities. What is that referring to, act or omission? Is it the act or omission that gives rise to the alleged liability?
Sorry. I mean, yes, I mean, that it's the act or omission in a lawsuit that gives rise to the claim, which gives rise to the liability. I mean, that's what we're dealing with at its core here.
So what was the act or omission that gives rise to the lawsuit here that was within the scope of the responsibilities of your client?
The act or omission was the alleged negligence in the course, which, as appellants have pled and have never amended their pleadings, occurred in the course of the mentorship. And this all, so the act or omission was the alleged negligence by negligent supervision of allowing Devin to ride an ATV and go pick unsupervised and to go pick that up.
I did press Ms. Spaulding on the possibility of this being circular, but on the other hand, if we just look at the plain language of the statute, if the act or omission is failure to supervise and the direction to engage in an act that was potentially harmful to the child, are you saying that that act, that specific act, is within the scope of his responsibilities?
Yes, I am. And I think this goes just beyond.
And how are you defining the scope of the person's responsibilities? And I guess that is the heart of what my question is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think scope of responsibilities in this particular context is somewhat of a malleable concept in the sense that Parenting with Purpose was a very distant organization that allowed its mentors to basically come up with their own activities, handle their own. There isn't a clearly defined parameters, except for the overnight stay parameter, as you pointed out, that really defines what the scope is. The scope is to be a good person, to be a mentor, to be a role model to this person, to provide, you know, healthy, positive relationships, all of which Mr. Brass was doing, all of which was in the course of his mentorship. And the act or omission that occurred was the alleged negligence that occurred during this event, during this mentoring event. And I think it goes to the point of...
So you would, just to be clear, you would define act or omission broadly, not narrowly as in the act was the negligence, because that's clearly outside the scope of the mission. You would say the act or omission was the supervision of the child or the teaching of the child to use a ATV, or but the negligent part is outside this, that may be outside the scope, but it wasn't outside the scope to provide general activities on the at the cabin.
I guess I don't believe that the negligence, the act or omission under the negligence, is outside the scope. I think that is within the scope. Unfortunately, negligent things such as accidents happen. And that's the point of this whole statute, is to protect a volunteer from accidents such as this. I guess negligence happens within the scope of someone's responsibilities, whether it's an act or omission, it's somewhat part and parcel. So I'm struggling to kind of unwind the two as separate and distinct concepts.
And presiding Judge Brian, is okay if I ask just one more clarifying question? Because you had made the statement that as long as the person was acting in good faith and they weren't being willful or reckless, then it was within the scope of responsibilities. But those are three separate factors, correct, under the statute? And in order to claim protection, you need all three. So the scope, mm-hmm, is somehow or another unrelated, and is another question.
They are questions, and they're all legal conclusions that the court had the discretion to make and determine that he was operating within the scope of his authority.
As long as there were not fact issues.
As long as there weren't fact issues in dispute. Material fact issues, which in here, I don't believe there are.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Bracken. Ms. Spaulding, your buck.
You're muted, I believe, Ms. Spaulding.
Sorry about that. The Pressler case, which is one of the cases that was initially cited by respondent and then a little bit more detailed by me, it does really make clear that there really should be four things that are looked at here. You know, first of all, should Brass, was he within the class? Should he even be looked at as being potentially protected by the statute? And then if so, then we have to go under the three prongs of the statute. And in the Pressler case, the court determined that it was undisputed that she fell within the class and then was acting within the scope, but was it a good faith and reckless and willful conduct? So I think I'm gonna come back to the fact that because this was an overnight stay and because Brass was aware that doing so was no longer part of his mentoring role, he deliberately removed himself from any protection. So whether or not this was a negligent, the circular argument that I'm trying to figure out how to articulate is whether it was negligent. And if we're going to say that all negligent conduct is always, no matter what, immune when somebody is within this, we still have to first ask, is the person within the class? And my argument is here that we don't even have to get to that because Mr. Brass was not within the class of persons protected here because he took Devin on an overnight stay. There are limitations and restrictions to mentorship programs. It makes sense why there is one. And Devin was injured during one of these overnight stays.
And Ms. Spaulding, I think this is a good time to ask this question given the way we ended the respondent's argument. Who decides the facts necessary to determine if someone's inside this class of protected persons? Is that a jury question or a judge question? And if so, what's our standard of review on those facts?
Well, just generally speaking, if any person qualifies or is whether immunity applies is, I think, a legal question, probably answerable by the district court, but it gets to be reviewed de novo by you guys. And you do not have to take or defer to what the district court determined in his analysis, especially because it's an awkward analysis because of the concentration of this permission slip. And the big argument of his opinion was really all about whether or not this was an overnight stay or did it occur at night. And so I don't think he really went into the analysis of whether or not immunity should have applied here in the first place. And that's what this court gets to look at with really fresh eyes.
But a fact dispute about whether a type of activity falls within or outside of the scope of somebody's agency, if you will, that fact dispute, if there's a question of fact on that issue, that's not something that can require denial of summary judgment.
It should have required denial of summary judgment here. And I do think that there were some cases that we cited that the courts or the trial courts were allowed to decide whether immunity applied and whether some of these factors applied. I think that there were some one or two cases. There's not a lot of cases regarding the statute to begin with, especially in the negligence context. But in any event, I do think that there is support in case law that juries have answered questions regarding whether somebody's protected under this statute. It has gone to the jury before.
This is what is challenging to me about this conceptually, is this idea that immunity is supposed to be decided early on without having to spend time in front of a jury finding facts. And yet I'm having a hard time discerning what exactly is the question that is decided by the court and what's decided by a jury. If it's decided by a jury, it sort of defeats the point of applying immunity and protecting individuals from having to defend lawsuits. And it's kind of awkward with the statute that refers to the scope, that the limit is regarding the scope of a person's activities falling inside or outside of the duties of the organization or an individual as an agent. Feels like that's a fact question almost all the time. And yet, you're right. It seems like the case law seems to allow for some questions to be resolved as a matter of law on that fact issue. Help us to, if we were to publish an opinion saying what is and what is not the jury's role versus the judge's role on that question, how would you frame our rule of law?
In this particular case, the issue regarding immunity was not raised initially, and we did go through much litigation, many depositions, and facts were developed. For example, it wasn't until PWP was brought into the case and, for example, the permission slip was disclosed for the first time. So some of the evidence regarding scope in particular, and in especially because of PWP and the documents I received from PWP describing what the relationships would have been. So I guess there's some facts that would not have been developed had this been dealt with initially. And it took really litigation and some depositions and discovery to define that. So
right, but those are still, I mean, they may be facts. But as far as deciding the fact question, it's in summary judgment. If there's a dispute, that goes to the jury. So I guess going back to my question, what is the rule of law that you think we should assert to guide district courts to know what part of the scope issue is a matter of fact and what, if any, is a matter of law when the parties disagree about whether an individual's activities fall within the scope of the service for the organization?
And perhaps I should have brought summary judgment in this particular case, but I think that the judge, I think that the whether or not the statute applied at all initially could have been answered by the judge in this case. And I think it should have been answered in that no, the statute does not apply. When it comes down to the factors, maybe that's more of a jury question when we have to define scope and what scope is. I mean, was allowing Devin to drive this ATV under these conditions without adult supervision, is that really what the purpose of PWP's mentorship is? So maybe that is more of a fact question that's more, better for a jury, but at the same point, whether the statute applied at all to initially begin with probably would be a judge determination.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for your briefs and the arguments this morning. It's been enjoyable and we went a little over time, but I appreciate both sides and your willingness to engage with the court. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.